problems out there.
Yeah. I think we can now move, because our people have been so good about on time, we actually reached the time. But this would be a general question that is relevant to presentations. So, Sarah, if anybody else wants to go on that whole issue about non-response, then feel free to contribute.
Sorry, I thought it was not
over.
Just a comment. I suppose Derek came out on the LC. I think, judging from the discussion, I think there's an interesting debate about whether to use surveys or other methods of collecting data. And I suppose, given the interest in terms of registered data and so on, that would be an alternative and one way of getting around some of the non-response issues. I think what's also interesting is that the vignette approach is very, in particular the presentation that showed the differences that occur when people's health status is anchored around vignettes. That, I mean, some of the non-response information that is pivotal, I think, to this is the information around income and measures of socioeconomic status, not so much only on health. And, finding ways similarly to anchor people's income levels or education levels to get accurate measures also to economic status is also important.
Okay, can we just sort of broaden it out and say, are there any issues that people feel that haven't been addressed or what are the priorities out there? But ask
Adam. Oliver, let's see. There's an underlying sort of assumption that unmet need is about to think. And it might be, but unmet need is consequent on other aspects of government policy, isn't it? So, for instance, NICE in the UK or similar HTA bodies around the world are trying to assess interventions that we ought not to be using because they're not they do not represent adequate value for money. So, from that, inevitably, you're going to get people saying that we're not getting stuff that we want. But there's not enough money in the system for everybody to get it. I think that the unmet need differentials across income is still very relevant, but unmet need as a sort of indicator is not necessarily inconsistent with government policies.
Okay, and last thing, given that we've got a very tight deadline, I think it's a bit nice to.
A comment on the shared data. I think that when now we are looking at programme care, and the main problem that we have. That are we measuring access or are we measuring needs? Because the problem is that it's maybe you find mature people are in chair, but many of them are elderly. And maybe it's just that there is nothing to do, like with doctors, or as Adam was saying, they decide not to pursue some treatments because they're not effective. And therefore, even if they need care, actually, they are too old, maybe, to give them very expensive treatments that have proven not to be effective, and therefore the healthcare system has actually decided not to do this. And therefore, somehow there are some needs that are not measured, and they needed care, but it has decided not to give them the care for a specific reason. And so it's really difficult to really see what we are measuring with this for bone care, in particular for the elderly. You don't know.
Okay, well then, maybe that's really a question rather than an answer, which is quite a nice way to finish this session. Thank you all the speakers and the participants in this, and we would show our appreciation.
For using Carlton, apologies, we've had three very important speakers in this session. And we'll start with Professor Mark McKee from Lawrence for 5 years.
Okay. Oh, well, thank you very much, Elliot, for the invitation. Getting through gritted teeth. Reducing Carlton inequality, what to read? What I'm saying, what do you really know? Because I know remarkably little about it, even having spent some time trying to find out. The starting point, obviously, is the report, Michael's report, the Commission on Social
help closing the gap in the generation and make a number of recommendations. And I think it's fair to say that this was a remarkably good cataloguing of the scale of inequalities worldwide. It told us a great deal about the magnitude and the nature of inequalities, and it made a number of recommendations, but the actual empirical evidence that said what should we do, what has worked, I think rather more problematic. And to try and help understand this a bit, I thought it might be useful to go beyond social inequalities, which is what we talk about primarily, because people are differentiated in many ways that can lead to inequalities in health. I could simply ask how many people here need correction of their eyesight, or how many are left-handed, or whatever, because all of those actually can have an impact in the way that our health develops. But there are lots of others: gender, age, occupation, income, wealth, social class, rurality, as already been mentioned in the context of Australia, education, ethnicity, religion, language. Fascinating example from Finland of the difference in health between the Swedish population, speaking population, and the Finnish speaking population. And a real debate in the literature: is it this much higher social capital that people see among the Swedish speakers, or is it because the Finns just drink too much? Disability, liberty, being in prison or not, and so on. And the question really, I think, comes down to which inequalities are we trying to reduce? And we then might think, having decided what inequalities we're trying to reduce, where do we intervene? Where might the problem be? Now, I put this up because no talk of inequalities is complete without it. This is where Albert and Margaret Whitehead is picture of the determinants of health, but actually it's remarkably helpful in thinking through all of the ways in which the world we live in ourselves impacts our levels of health and how they might differ. Let me start off with gender. Men die before women, but the gap is wider in some places than in others. And if we look across Europe, we're seeing gaps of maybe 2 years in life expectancy, up to about 15 years in life expectancy. A huge gap across Europe in terms of the life expectancy of men and women. Now, as far as I'm aware, there's no fundamental genetic or biological reason why the gap should be 14 or 15 years in one country and 2 or 3 years in another. And then when we look beyond that, we find that it's not inevitable. So, for example, we take, and these are unusual populations, admittedly, Polish Seventh-day Adventists. There is no gender gap in survival beyond the age of 40 in this population that does not drink and that does not smoke. And another study from Finland suggesting that about 50% of the gender gap in life expectancy is attributable to smoking and alcohol. So for this inequality, it seems that lifestyle factors play a major role, and we might start to look at those as to where we might intervene. The unfortunate situation across Europe, of course, is that young women everywhere are behaving much more like young men, with adverse consequences for their health. And this is an example of the consequences of binge drinking that can be seen in the streets of any major any weekend. Then let's go across the Atlantic to look at the United States. White Americans live longer than African Americans, and the men are in blue, the boys are in blue, and the girls are in pink. And there's a significant gap between the two, and there has been for some considerable time. So what's going on there? Well, we've looked at deaths from amenable causes of death, avoidable mortality, death that should not occur in the presence of timely and effective care. Now, there is remarkably little overlap in states. If we take each state and look at the trends in deaths that can be prevented by effective care, and look at how they've been over the last few years, the white population in almost every state is separate from the African-American population. There's almost a gap. Now, the differences, the one at the very bottom among the African-American population, are those very small number of rather atypical African-Americans, such as Barack Obama, who came from Hawaii, and the one above it is Utah, which is also a somewhat atypical state as well. But essentially, there is a significant gap in these causes attributable to failures of healthcare. So for this inequality, we're looking at issues around access to healthcare, I think, primarily. There are other factors as well, but this is a major one. There's an obvious solution. Well, it's obvious to us in Europe, universal healthcare. We poor, deprived Europeans can do it. Why not the world's remaining superpower? But we have to concede that that has proven too difficult over time. And there are lots of other things. Recommendations from the Commonwealth Fund, ARC, the American Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and others, interpreter services, outreach workers, culturally sensitive policies, and so on. So certainly more could be done. In passing, I have to say that some of our work was stimulated by a paper in Foreign Policy a few years ago when the Washington correspondent of the Financial Times wrote a piece on the fate of Europe, which he saw as disappearing and as falling apart, being taken over by Islamic extremists with welfare states that were running out of money and health systems that were collapsing. And in response, we were asked to comment on the health aspect. And we said that if you're a physician giving advice to a young African-American with diabetes, the best advice you can give them is to get on a plane for Europe, because by doing so, they improve their chances of survival about 7 times. So, what do we know about moving forward, about making a difference? Public health researchers, I would argue, have been remarkably good, and we've had many examples of measuring and understanding inequalities in health, and understanding the complexities that underlie the interpretation of the data. We've been much less successful in discovering what to do about these inequalities, even over 100 years ago, after Karl Marx commented on the philosophers being very good at interpreting the world, whereas the point was to change it. So let's start off with the main source of evidence that we in public health always look to, the Cochrane Library. And if you put in, as you see here, your search inequality did not match any documents. No paper around any inequality. So what do I do? We draw it about what?
Right.
Yeah, we do know what works, and they actually don't need the research. Generally, giving people money, food, clean water, shelter, and protection from violence is a good thing. Giving them adequately remunerated, satisfying and rewarding jobs is a good thing. Not just for their health, but for lots of other reasons. Building them safe and healthy environments is good. And also stopping other people, be they warlords or tobacco and alcohol company executives, from actually killing them. Those are all good things. Now, we could do very detailed studies to show that, but I suspect that we really don't need to. And voting is a good idea as well, because voting does reduce inequality. Now, the sort of greeny turquoise colour captures right-wing governments. The pinky, salmony coloured reflects left-wing governments. But you will be aware that there is a misclassification at the end of the period here. So, that's it. I'll stop. Or will I? Maybe I should say a little bit more. That really is about it, but let's try and pull it out a little bit further. The good news is that there is a changing emphasis of research. It's gradually shifting from identification to diagnosis and onwards to prescription. We take a medical analogy. And there are different entry points for intervention. And there is growing experience in implementing and evaluating interventions and policies. The problems we've heard about in the first session are that the pathways from disadvantage to ill health are often highly complex, confounders lurk everywhere, there are variable timelines everywhere, interventions are difficult to implement and beset with unintended consequences, especially when those interventions are so poorly thought out as they are in some countries. And there's often a reluctance, an extreme reluctance, in fact an aversion or even an allergy by policymakers to subject their beliefs or their dreams or their fantasies to any form of evaluation. We do have natural experiments, but often they can be very misleading, particularly ceteris paribus, because we assume that all else is equal, except that it rarely is. And context is all. Evaluation of cycle lanes is a means. Well, a Dutch cycle lane is at least something you can cycle in, whereas the English one in Finsbury Park in North London, or the one in the Czech Republic where you require a BMX that can vault, they're more problematic. So we have to realise that words mean, as Lewis Carroll said, what you choose them to mean. The first steps, I think, are to decide who are the disadvantaged groups, and it's not just social inequalities, then to discover how they're disadvantaged and discover how this is impacting on health, identifying where it may be possible to intervene and find the evidence. Cochrane doesn't help too much, though I'll come back to that, it does help a little. The Campbell collaboration, many of you will be familiar with, is an incredibly rich source of material that will help us to understand what can be done. I try to take up what I think is a really useful framework, and the way I've allocated different things to it may be inexact and maybe it can go into other areas, but this is something that's been around for about 20 years from I came from Warren and Margaret. The approaches to reducing inequality, strengthening individuals, strengthening communities, making sure that people have access to what they need, and then the bigger picture emerging map we're going from top to all change. Now, what I'm going to say is highly selective within the shortness of time. Effectively, what we're saying is we really need to improve the health of the worst off in society, and we have the three-volume expert textbook of public health, which covers that in some detail, and I clearly can't read all of that today. So I'll just pick out a few bits. Strengthening individuals, supporting individual health. Well, we actually know that much of the gap in life expectancy and health and so on is due to a number of risk factors. There are social determinants as well, but if we could just do something about some of the big killers like smokers. And then the Cochrane reviews do help us. For example, telling us where smoking cessation activities work best, what works in the workplace, what doesn't, in schools, in pregnancy, patients in hospitals and so on. It also tells us about what works in terms of who does it. Physician advice, nurse advice, partners don't help very much. So there is evidence from randomized controlled trials that actually help us to know what works at an individual level. But of course the problem is that the individual level is only one part of it, and we also need to look at the environment. And we need to try to understand where we are on a scale that stretches on the one hand to California, where it is almost impossible to smoke in a public place, to China, where, as we heard recently, it is actually a requirement in one province to smoke cigarettes. So we have that spectrum. We are moving more towards the California bit. Germany is more towards the China end of the spectrum. Austria is sort of even further, but nobody knows what's going on there, so they're going to get castigated for it. So there's a spectrum, and clearly we need to look at the societal policies. What about strengthening communities? Well, the way I felt was helpful to look at this was from an estate agent's perspective. Where would you like to live? And that has implications for your health, but also for all sorts of things. Somewhere where there are more jobs, there's a more pleasant environment, reduced crime, and better education. And what is the evidence? Well, jobs, getting people into work. Politically controversial, but welfare to work does work in the randomised controlled trials that have been done. We know that getting people into work is a good thing. In all countries studied so far, those in employment are in better health than those who are not. Selection factors play a part. It's a complex interpretation. But even in a study from Italy that looked at people getting people out of work, 100% of the salary that they are, the income they would have got in work, they were still worse off in health terms than if they'd been in work. So work is actually good for you, thankfully. And welfare to work does seem to work from the Campbell Review. Living in a nice environment is good. Well, I'll summarise this, but just say, basically, read our paper. It's online in the International Journal of Epidemiology, where we reviewed all the evidence recently. But to cut a very long story short, environments that are perceived to be safe and attractive, they're associated with physical activity, they're associated with lower rates of all sorts of things. Living in a violent neighbourhood is actually associated with an increased risk of mortality from this cardiovascular disease. In Sweden, a country that is not known for its violence, and so there are all sorts of benefits from living in a nice place. Objective measures of walkability. Clearly, if you live in Los Angeles and try to go for a walk, as one of my former students did, you're at risk of being arrested. In fact, he was. They couldn't work out why anyone was so insane as to try to walk there. Whereas if you live in Nepal, it's very difficult not to walk. Density of fast food outlets is associated with obesity, and so on and so forth. It's not just the objective aspects of the environment, it's the perceptions as well. What about changing your environment? And you're probably familiar with the Moving to Opportunity Project. It's a nice little study, that's a big study in fact, and it randomly allocated people to giving them a housing voucher that they could only use to move to a rich, relatively rich area, a voucher where they could move to anywhere, or basically leaving them where they were. So it was changing people's environment by actually taking them and putting them in a different environment. And what do we see? Rather complicated results, because girls moving to a low-poverty area did very well. Improved educational attainment, better mental health, and less involvement in crime. Boys moving to a low-poverty area were more likely to engage in crime, more likely to drink in hazardous ways, more likely to take drugs and smoke, and a significant increase in non-sports injuries. So what's happening there? Well, what they think was happening was basically girls moving to a more affluent area aspire to move upwards. They try to emulate their peers. Boys decide to give up and just be jealous of what's going on around them and try to acquire the additional resources by stealing them. So that's the sense of value, but there's a major gender gap there. Things are not always what you might think. Low crime environments, major selling point in the property market, and again, significantly associated with crime. I'll give you the example of the Swedish study with heart disease and with other things. What works? In fact, putting people in jail probably doesn't work. Closed-circuit TVs are effective, but not to the extent of having them on every street corner as we do in this country. But if you limit them to car parks, they stop people taking cars. Having them all over the world, the UK, as you probably know, has adopted the Stasi approach to surveillance. The problem is trying to find a needle in a haystack, so the solution is to tip a ton of hay on top of it with information they collect. Improved street lighting is good. Enhanced policing of crime hotspots is good. Mentoring of juvenile offenders is moderately effective, particularly for delinquency and aggression, but less so in tackling drug use and low achievement, and it's better where emotional support is central. The key point is there are things we can do. There is evidence in crime. There may be no evidence in counterterrorism, but there is evidence in crime prevention. We know what works and we know what doesn't. Improved education in an area. Well, education, as we know, is clearly associated with better health. I've taken this from Michael's report again from Korea, but lots and lots of examples. What works after school programs show no demonstrable impact on children's education attainment. These are all systematic reviews, by the way, from the Campbell Collaboration, so they're not just one-off studies. So the point I'm making is the evidence is there. Parental involvement intervention can achieve significant improvements when you give education and training to the parents and rewards and incentives to the children in another systematic review. So there are ways of improving education, and there are lots of others. The Head Start programme, many of you will be familiar with as well, launched in the 1960s as part of the Great Society under LBJ. Evidence of early benefits when the kids go into school with better numeracy and literacy, but some evidence of the effects fade out, called Head Start fade out. What do we see? Again, differences. Among the white population, participation associated with significantly increased probability of completing high school, attending college, and elevated earnings in their early 20s. So long-term benefits. African-American, slightly different, but participation still associated with a significant reduction in being charged or convicted of a crime. And a knock-on effect, this positive effect with siblings. So it's not just the individuals involved, but also the families. So that's one bit of evidence that we can look at. And of course, that has informed sure start of the United Kingdom, albeit that it's been implemented in a very, very different way and significantly less resources. Improving access to essential services, a very complex topic that I'm not going to say much about, but essentially there's a strong argument for looking at underserved populations and finding out why they're not taking up the care that they need and how they might be encouraged to do so. But the context there is often very, very important. It's not just distance, it's not just opening hours and so on. Decisions are made by families and friends as well as individuals and so on and so forth. And then to the fourth strand, encouraging macroeconomic and cultural change. Again, one of Michael's slides, you've probably all seen it so many times that I don't need to go over it. But the key point here is that the United Kingdom has a higher rate of poverty before you take into account financial transfers, but after you take into account the financial transfers, it has a lower rate of poverty than the United States. So you can actually reduce levels of inequality and reduce poverty by taking money from rich people and giving them to poor people, something that a guy called Robin Hood discovered 800 years ago, but which has taken a long time to be ingrained into mainstream thinking. Interesting finding paper that I discovered when I was doing the work for this talk, and it looks at the probability of poor health in people who are unemployed compared to those who are in employment. These are odds ratios. So what we're seeing here is that in the Anglo-Saxon welfare states, Britain and Ireland and so on, as you might expect, the odds of being in poor health are much greater among people who are unemployed compared to employed. But for women, it's actually worse to be unemployed in the Scandinavian countries, and for men, it's worse to be unemployed in the Bismarckian Germany, Austria, and so on. And actually, the gaps are not so large in the southern and eastern countries. I'm just going to take some slides like this, so I can't remember which ones I actually. And the One of the explanations, well, it's not altogether surprising that there should be a big gap in the Anglo-Saxon countries, because basically we're mean. We means test everything. We live in entitlements and make it very difficult for people. The argument in the Scandinavian countries is that women find it much more difficult to collect all the entitlements because of the more generous maternity leave and part-time working and so on. So it's fine while they're actually pregnant, but when you become unemployed, having missed out on all the contributions and so on, it may be more difficult. Very speculative for the authors. They didn't come down conclusively on what the answers are, because the findings were unexpected. And they think that perhaps in the Bismarckian systems, it's the male breadwinner, the role of the male breadwinner, that is particularly challenging when men lose their job. I think fundamentally moving ahead, how do we go forward? A lot of it really depends on where you come from. Are we deciding to tackle the immediate causes of ill health, like tobacco and alcohol and poor nutrition? We could do an enormous amount simply by tackling smoking adequately in the United Kingdom. You know, the rates of smoking among the poorest have really not fallen anything like as much as they have among the better off. Or do you think that this is just a sticking plaster and we need to change society fundamentally? Or are you somewhere in the middle? I think that there are lots of inequalities in health on many dimensions and taking many forms. It's not just social inequalities, it's a whole range of inequalities. And what you do really depends on who you're trying to help, what the problem is, and where you can intervene. And then you can ask what works. But my plea would be that if you do something, please evaluate it and tell the world whether it really did work, so that we can learn from your experience. And I have a bit more to say next time I do this call. Thank you. Challenges, criticisms.
Yeah. My time is more than questions.
Because I have to disappear all after this call, right?
No questions.
Two points, if I can. The first one, on your slide, where you say, well, we do know what works, your first point was give people money. Mm. Now, as far as I'm aware, the evidence which we have from high-income countries, at least, I cannot think of any study which demonstrates convincingly that once we control for all confounding factors, that giving people money would make them healthier.
I'm sure you're right. I don't think there's any study that shows it either, but it does seem intrinsically a good idea. I just wondered if we really need research to show it, to be honest. And it was a bit like the research looking at people in cold houses. For a long time, there was an issue in the United Kingdom with a very high winter mortality. People were arguing, do we know all the mechanisms involved? Do we know if it's a good idea to have warmer houses? Actually, does it really matter? It's a good thing to do anyway.
Yes, but general inequalities in society and not specifically health inequalities. And what you're saying is that giving people money is going to narrow income inequalities, but may have no effect on health inequalities. And, I mean, that leads me to my second point, perhaps, that my reaction here is a bit like the reaction I felt when I read the Marmot report, that yes, it convincingly demonstrates these socioeconomic inequalities worldwide, but then when one gets to the prescriptions, what is basically asked for is a radically different society from the one in which we live.
Mm. And that's my final question.
Yes.
Do we want that or not?
Yeah. Yes, but
political questions.
I mean, if we want to reduce health inequalities, I think that to give the sort of identification of many, many different dimensions in which we work is perhaps not so useful. I think what we have to do is prioritize. We have to identify where could we make the biggest impact, and also in relation to the cost which is going to impose upon us. So I think rather than trying to work on this very large canvas, perhaps one could try to focus a little bit more on what is going to have an impact and what is feasible to do.
Well, I'm not clear where the robust empirical evidence is that will allow you to do that at the minute. That's the difficulty. Because when you look at the rigorous randomized controlled trial, and you know, we've got lots of natural experiments, and if you look in particular at the economics literature, it is full of studies of natural experiments. But the real difficulty is that all else is not always equal. And the only way to find this out is to actually do experiments, which could be done. I mean, the United States have done many large-scale randomized trials in areas like education and criminal justice and so on, we just don't do them in Europe. And that's the problem, because I don't accept that we can. I think when we look at the comparisons, there are just too many problems around variable time lags and confounding and so on. We can speculate, but then the alternative question is, do we actually need all of that evidence? Because there are some things that may be right from a social justice perspective, where we don't have the exact evidence of the mechanism for health, but we simply say it's the right thing to do. And I think that's a political question. It's not a question that an academic epidemiologist can answer. Nor should they, actually, because some of these things are intrinsically unevaluatable. Some of them can be evaluated, and we don't do it. But some of the biggest things really can't be.
Julian. It was just a specific point about the US and access to health services. Because it was interesting, you said one of the findings wasn't it? It was the only time really you mentioned health services, access to health services, for poor individuals in the US. My understanding of the latest US evidence, and I'm open to correction, this is stuff I'm thinking of is quite old, which I think. That actually there's something of a U-shape in the US, that actually that the poor relatives in need use health services about the same as the rich.
Because of Medicare
and Medicaid. What is different is that when they actually get there, they don't necessarily receive the same service.
Yeah.
And they aren't necessarily prescribed the maybe the most effective drugs or and so on.
It's not
just a question of access.
No, it's not.
Is that what happens when you actually get there?
I'm grossly simplifying. The reality of it is that an African American has about 13 times the probability of dying at the age of 50 from diabetes, where nobody should die at the age of 50 from diabetes, of anybody in any country in Europe, whereas for a white American, it's about 4 or 5 times higher, which indicates there's a fundamental problem with the system. But there are a whole range of factors. In Medicaid, there's the issue of non-entitlement. If you're a recent migrant, you're not entitled to Medicaid until you've been in the country 5 years. If you drop out of it, then it can take 6 months to get back on. When you look at the case studies of some of the qualitative work, the big problems that arise are people who are on a course of treatment for a long-term condition. Very notorious one of the kidney cancer, who actually kept getting into remission whenever they were in Medicaid. The parents got a job and went out of it, and then it was 6 months before they could get back, and the child died. And just one story, but it captures the reality of it. So, yes, you know, I reduced the entire problems of the US health system to 2 slides. We could talk about it forever, but access is not the only problem. There are many others.
But it's other countries too. It's actually when they actually get to this. When the poor get to
Absolutely.
And when they get that's often the problem.
And we see that in the UK,
so we see it in
the UK. And we see it
back. And other countries, and the pro-rich referrals of specialists.
Well, there's a lovely line from a paper that was looking at the US, that applies equally to Europe. Nephrology, or kidney surgeons in the United States, transplant kidneys into people who look like themselves, have white, male, and middle class, and actually the empirical evidence is absolutely that's the case. Sorry, was something?
Adam Oliver, just on Julian's point, I think it's been estimated that about 60% of the American poor don't have access to Medicaid.
And a very high state. And also it's worse.
Very enormously high state.
Yeah.
But my main point actually is related to earnings, I think. Well, it's deadly, so very, very related to earnings. But I just wanted to extend it a little bit more into a question, really. So basically what you might be saying, Martin, which I agree with, there are things that, you know, just policies that are self-evidently good.
Well, depending on your political perspective, one of the slides I took out was, there's a cover from The Economist from 2001, Does Inequality Matter? And I've got a lovely line from the BBC.
You preempted the end of my question. Let me just finish what I'm saying and then you can respond.
Sorry about
that. So there seems to be things that are self-evidently good, which is what Rudolf Kleins and others for years, intrinsically, but in and of themselves, you can extend that and say that, you know, there are things that we can all imagine that would be good for poor people's health, or good for people who are in poor health. So try to get them to quit smoking, which may be related to the things that Julian might talk about later. And all sorts of other policies. But there's no evidence, as far as I can see, that, or very little evidence, that would have indicated that, or even conceptually, that there might be little reason to believe that a lot of these policies will actually narrow health inequalities. So my question really is, you know, really for everybody, is that, you know, if there are things that are self-evidently good, and if we know pretty much that these things will improve the health of the worst health, should we just concentrate on trying to raise the floor
rather than narrowing the distribution?
Perhaps. But I think that ultimately is a political question, because I don't actually think that the research that we're talking about here can answer some of these questions. I think it can get much closer to answering. I think there's lots more we can do in terms of evaluating interventions, but I think fundamental questions of the distribution of resources within society are not things that we can answer. And just because they improve health, no politician, as far as I have, I'm aware, has ever said the fundamental goal of our country, this government has been put in power to improve the health of the population. And we're not interested in anything else. I mean, they say, we're here to promote equality, we're here to defend our boundaries, our borders, we're here to do all sorts of things. But nobody actually says our fundamental goal is to improve health. And that being the case, then it doesn't make sense that we should expect research which shows that improving health, even though it may have other effects on all sorts of things, and we'll be winners and losers anyway. There's no reason why we should expect them to jump to do those things, because it's never particularly high on their priorities. And we've seen that every country that has a coalition government gives the health portfolio to a minority party. You know, you can see, take somewhere like Northern Ireland, where we're a permanent coalition, you can see which party is the weakest by which one's got the health ministry, the health department.
Right. I mean, you've been even one step further saying that we shouldn't. Well, maybe a lot of people shouldn't be concerned with health at all.
I do think realistic, but I think that we should be. I think if we, and you know, if we as health researchers and health professionals aren't concerned about it, then nobody will be. So we need to keep the flag, you know, waving the flag, but we shouldn't be naive about it. You know, it is not immediately clear. And look at the debate on the ban on smoking in England. You know, there we had a health secretary who was opposing it. Yeah, what do we make of that?
Thank you very much for your excellent presentation and entertaining as well. Our next speaker is Orlin Lilburg from the University of Tokyo.
Discussion and on evidence and what can we do as scientists, it seems to be a bit awkward to tell you how the wealth of politics contribute to the reduction of health inequalities, and I'm certainly not going to go there. It's an impossible question to answer. What I will try to do is to say something about some of the things that we have been thinking about in Sweden and Scandinavia for 20 or 30 years or so. But a starting point might be why on earth should we look at welfare policies to public health outcomes in the first place? And it's obvious for you, but when you talk to colleagues in sort of policy in Sweden and otherwhere, it's important to point out that public health policies are more than health care policies. Since social factors are important for health, policies that aim at tackling social problems at large should be of interest, are of interest. And it's also interesting to note, I think, that many welfare policies and welfare programs are linked to health and disabilities and their economic consequences. Historically, a lot of those programs are brought into being because we want to protect sick people or people who cannot support themselves on the labour market from being poor. And sort of relating to the things that Martin was discussing just a minute ago, I think that very often when you try to find evaluations of things, it tend to be evaluations of things that can be evaluated. And that seems logical enough, but some of these, I think Martin said, some of the biggest things cannot be evaluated. And I think, in a sense, welfare policies and welfare types are very, very difficult to evaluate. But still, I think we have to consider what kind of possible consequences might there be for health and living conditions of different styles in arranging welfare policies. One of my sort of basic claims, I think, is that social determinants of health, that what Michael has been writing about in this report, is in a sense the same as welfare resources on an individual level. And this is sampling levels discussed in Scandinavian welfare research and research on living conditions since the late 1960s. And one of my first academic teachers, Stevie Wanson, defined welfare as the resources by which the individual can control and consciously direct her conditions of life. And defining it that way, I think the welfare resources that are necessary to lead a good life also constitutes the key social determinants of health, including economic resources, but also working conditions, housing conditions, education and knowledge, etc., which are, in a sense, very much linked also to economic resources. Economic resources, when we have looked into this, the relations between different areas of life, economic resources always come out as very central, because economic resources can be transferred from times and resources. Well, how do welfare resources on the individual level then link to welfare states or welfare state regimes or welfare policies? Well, as you all know, these kind of resources can be generated in different areas, different arenas. They could be very personal, they could be generated in the family or external network, or they could be generated on the market, or could be called individual resources. But in addition to that, I think it's important to note that there are collective resources that we can draw on if we need to. And in most of our societies, these are generated to a large extent, not solely, but to a large extent by welfare state institutions. That will assist citizens with, as anyone would put it, the collective matters that arise from the demands and possibilities that all individuals in all societies are facing in the life cycle. And what might these be? Well, you have to raise children, you have to sustain your family, you have to take care of your old, you have to take care of your ill. All of these challenges are facing all people and all families, and you can arrange that differently, and how you arrange it will affect people's lives. And this is basically what stated here, that these collective resources include basically two kinds, those in cash and those in kind, or cash and care, which I call it here. So cash resources are social insurances, covering income loss, for instance, due to illness, unemployment, or old age. Care includes welfare services of various kinds, supplied free of charge or heavily subsidized, including childcare, healthcare, care for the old, care for the disabled. And I think it's fair to say that the supply and quality of such collective resources are important for people's possibilities to sustain their health and well-being. Of course, these collective resources are more important for those in the bottom end, for those people in society who have very little individual resources. For those, it will be crucial that the collective resources that the welfare state or society or other institutions supply are of good quality and are available. So in short then, I think that key welfare resources are also the core social determinants of health. I think that income standards or income distribution factors are central. And policies that reduce poverty risks by adding economic resources at periods or situations in life characterized by vulnerability are likely to buffer health risks in various ways. But then again, are there any evidence? And I would be brave enough to say that there are much evidence, but I would give you one case that we were discussing earlier, the case of family policies. Family policies are fairly new to welfare policies in modern welfare states. Basically, it supports the family and children at two of the sort of peak poverty risk phases in the round two poverty cycles, we call that. But it also entails subsidized childcare services, etc., etc. You can look at family policies both in terms of the total generosity of the systems, but also the type of support, how it's channeled to families. There are these policies supporting dual earner families or not? Are they more supporting traditional family roles, or are they very much at all in the first place? And of course, there are mechanisms through poverty reductions, but there are also other mechanisms likely that could affect health of children and families. And all kinds of policies that may affect children may have immediate effect, but they may also have long-term effects. And that if they have a life cycle perspective, family policies could have effects in both now and later on. This is simply a graph showing family policy generosity in 18 OECD countries, or maybe 17 in this slide. Family policy generosity being measured as at the legislated rights. This is data from what they call the European Family Project. On the one axis, expressed as the percentage of average workers' wage, and on the other axis is the percentage for children. As you can see, there is far from a perfect relationship, but there is still a relationship showing that the more generous family policies are, the lower generally are the rates of child poverty. Has this anything to do with child poverty? We might add here that this effect, or if we could call it an effect, is not only due to the amounts of resources being paid out by these systems, they're also due to the fact that some systems, mainly the dual earning family systems, support also two earners and thereby sustain higher income for the market. Let's go to the effect on child care. We did and presented some analysis of family policy generosity and infant mortality. And it turns out actually that, quite unexpectedly, there is a relationship. The more generous family policy, the lower is the infant mortality rates. Not a strong relationship, but still a little relationship. And it also holds when you look at child injury mortality. But if you look, these are just sort of the plots, but if you look at the bit more rigorously, this was based on a full cross-section of time series analysis from the 1970s onwards, 18 OECD countries. And the basic message here is that the generosity of the type, dual earner type support, is significantly linked to lower income mortality rates. So, the more generous support you have, the support to two breadwinners is linked with lower infant mortality. But then again, the issue I think today was to talk about health inequalities and not health levels. And that is so much more difficult. If it's sort of a little bit speculated to say that the type and level of generosity of welfare policies may be related to levels of public health, I think it's much more speculated to say anything about impact on inequalities. But it's also important to know, despite the fact that there is very little research, that it depends on what we mean with inequalities. For sure, if you look at the Mankiewicz papers, you find that relative inequalities persist irrespective of the social policy regime or welfare regime or type of welfare state you have. But other types of inequalities actually do form some kind of patterns. And I have sometimes argued in a picture like that Martin Buber showed here very often, that absolute inequalities and in particular levels of mortality among the worst off seems to be a bit structured. And this is just arranging countries according to the relative inequalities between white and blue color in panel A, the absolute risk differences between white and blue color, and yes, in the fine panel, yes, the absolute level of mortality risks among blue color. And you can see that in this slide, Sweden and Ireland seem to share the same fate. It becomes larger differences when you look at absolute risk differences. But when you look at the absolute probability of death among blue-collar workers, it's lowest in Sweden and highest in Ireland. So if you were born to this world knowing that you might end up as a blue-collar worker and would choose in country, I think you would good chance that you would choose Sweden. But if you were choosing on basis of this information, you wouldn't have an idea of where to choose or where to stay. So I think, and of course, how can this be? Well, it's of course due to the white-collar people in Sweden having very low mortality levels as well, driving the relative differences. And you might say that, well, this might be seen as a problem, but it cannot be a problem with white-collar people have very low mortalities. So I think when we try to evaluate policies and try to say, are we doing things the right way, it might be actually that we should look at the sort of the results of mortality and absolute mortality levels, saying that this might be a good thing. We're not finished yet. There's still a large gap. Why is this the case in Sweden? It's an egalitarian policy, but still this is better than that. So some concluding remarks. I think that the sum of welfare policies are likely to affect public health, very much in the way that Martin was saying before. And you can just make the imagination that you wouldn't have any social protection system. I think that would be kind of harsh society, actually. It seems from some of the stuff that we've been doing, contributing to Martin Marmot's commission, actually, that universal policies appear to be the better public health. It's a bit speculative, but anyway. But still, there's very little research, I think, regarding the impact on inequalities. Still, we have a lot of work to do, and basically, I think there's a huge lack of data to address these issues. But also, I think we need to be a bit humble. We can see from the slides I presented and from much other slides that there are many factors affecting health and inequalities. And there are countries like Japan that has no family policy whatsoever, that still have very low infant mortality rates. So obviously there are different roads to success. And I think that's important to remember when discussing policies. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. Now, Julian wants to go now. Julian, we'll take questions after Julian's presentation.
All right. One more. Thanks.
Let's remind us that social medicine at a time was defined by one of the pioneers as politics by other means. And I really think that is the challenge. For some reason, people in our societies accept large degrees of inequalities in income, in lifestyles, and so on, and they are really provoked when they also see the inequalities in health. And as we are trying to work for them in democratic policies to achieve the better results for them and their offspring and their neighbors and so on, we're trying to pull them along to face some of the consequences of the moral response to inequalities in health. And there I think medicine have a role. Even though you can say that in the end this is just politics and we have no right really to intervene. And whenever I listen to Mr. Marmot, I find it curious because in my perception he's an amateur sociologist. And if I had made the same arguments on the basis of my profession, no one would listen. I would never get the press or anything. But it is because he's using the great merits of objective medicine to make these statements, and then appealing to this curious mix of responses in people, that we can actually make advances. And I think it would be really sad if people in epidemiology sort of refused to take it up, because this is just politics. And I also don't think it is. I think the way Oliver combines what we know about different societies and the way they come out in distributional regimes, and the way then this is linked to health, also tells us that we can use knowledge to construct better societies. This isn't just about preference. It is also about looking at the data. And even though everything disappears when you look really closely and nothing is solid, then I still think it's very important that we take up the challenge. And therefore, I do not appreciate, even though I also laugh, the ridicule which we had before, because I really think it is something we have to take serious, and I think the LSE is in the middle of that for historical reasons, and I would like it to stay there. And clearly, we have a lot of colleagues in the Commission who are skeptical about anything we suggest in this area, because basically they think there are collective goods from inequalities. So we're up against this all the time, and the former speaker would be a favorite invitee at an ECFIN conference, really giving the whole exercise, and we're just getting back to basics, and let's just get richer. And so I sorry for this, but this would, I think, be an opener. So it's not so, I just appreciate what you did, and I think it's good.
Yeah, thanks for this intervention. I think this could generate a huge debate and discussion. Unfortunately, the amateur sociologist is not present to defend himself. So, but I would like to probably proceed with the next presentation now, and then after Julius' presentation, we can have a discussion.
It's relevant to your point, but you know, it's what I'm going to be talking about, because I'm going to be talking about the individual rather than the collective. I'm chairman of something called Health England, hence this thing here. And it basically, Health England is supposed to advise the government, it's a board set up by the government to advise it on preventive healthcare, which is really my area, I have to say. But I got very interested in the whole area of how we actually use incentives to try and change individual behaviour, which is short of the kind of the Marmot approach of a more a more revolutionary approach, called more desire for a more fundamental different society in these terms. Let me just go through it quickly. Behaviour, individual behaviour, as indeed Martin McKee was saying, terribly important in determining healthcare, in determining health overall. This is a sort of back of the envelope calculation for health affairs, really. But it showed, in arguing that about 40% of premature mortality before the age of 75, is about 40% is due to behaviour of one kind or another, and then genetic factors, social factors. But healthcare is interesting in that, 10%. 10% of, we estimate 10% of premature mortality due to healthcare. I think they're pretty much back of envelope calculations. When I looked into them in more detail, they've assembled a lot of evidence from a lot of areas, and the genetic one particularly seems to need to be essentially residual. That was the last proportion of areas they couldn't explain. obviously, behaviour is important. And this shows for Europe the inequalities in one aspect of behaviour in smoking, but above the line basically meaning that the poor smoke more, below the line the poor smoke less. Quite interesting actually, some of those, I think, below the line, the Mediterranean countries there. But with as you can see, substantial inequalities in smoking, also in obesity, substantial inequalities again between poor and rich. And obviously these contributing to such the inequalities in health that we need to actually observe. There's one case there, which is Latvia, I think, where the rich are killing more fatter than the poor. Now, yes, there are immediately from a thinks about this whole question of individual behaviour, we need to have some. What we don't have and what we lack seems to be a theories of individual behaviour, theories of explanation as to why people poor eat too much, drink too much, smoke too much, and too much. And there are sort of two approaches to go to it. Now, one is this comes from the Forsyth Report, a British government institution that looked at the sources of obesity. And they developed what they call the obesogenic environment. It's very much a Marlowe's style approach, but basically, as you can see, a nice, simple understanding of the way in which obesity is set up. I have to say, I find this extremely unhelpful. I don't find this as a good way to think, and certainly if you present it to politicians. The interesting one of the politicians did point out to me, the interesting about it too, is it's all self-enclosed. There's a kind of barrier around it. There's no way in to actually do anything about any of this. It's represented with this, this dire problem about which there's no way you're probably short of some sort of major convulsion in society to change things dramatically. Now, however, I do think there is one fundamental problem in the public health arena, and this will be also deeply familiar to those of you who are more specialist in public health than me, and that concerns time. And I'm haunted by this quote from David Hume, the 18th century Scottish philosopher, about the essentially the problem of time. It does seem to me that the essential Humean problem is that the costs of undertaking unhealthy activities accrue in the long term in the future. So the costs of an 18-year-old taking up smoking will not suffer from that until he or she is 60 or more. Whereas the benefits of taking up smoking are immediate. They'll enjoy it, they'll get credit from their peers, be cool, and so on. And similarly, the benefits of undertaking unhealthy activities accrue a long time in the future, whereas the costs of doing so are immediate, or not invariably. There are some people who enjoy jogging, the benefits of it accrue usually a long time in the future. And this exacerbates three kinds of problems. Now, I don't know how many of you are familiar with the newish science of behavioral economics. This is where economists have finally realized what most of the rest of the world do already, that people don't always behave entirely rationally. And they've developed a number of problems that people they have problems processing information. It's not that they don't have the information, they just have problems processing the information. They have a problem, this is an Aristotelian term, the crazier, the weakness of the will, basically, that people have problems about the weakness of the will, and projection problems. They have problems of projecting themselves into a different situation and imagining what their level of welfare and utility would be like in a different situation. And the classic case would there be the 18-year-old trying to project themselves into what it would be like to be 60 and having lung cancer. And all of these problems are actually exacerbated by the length of time involved, by the difference in time. If there's only a gap between one day between the benefits and costs of healthy activity, you get a very different result than if you have a gap of 15 years. So that is a fundamental problem, and it means that we have to think about, well, how can we change behaviour, bearing in mind that fundamental fact. Most of these policies will involve something like bringing forward the benefits from undertaking healthy activity, bringing it forward in time, or raising the costs of unhealthy activities now, and vice versa for healthy activities. So, what are the ways that we can try and change behaviour? Well, there's provision of information, health education, one form or another. Regulation, and incentives, which is taxes, tax subsidised them, and libertarian paternalism, which I'm sure you're all deeply familiar with, but will I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment or two. Provision of information and health education, well, I'm not a great believer in this. I think most of the studies they've been to try and look at the effectiveness of health education indicate that it's ineffective. When it does work, it probably tends to worsen the health inequalities because it tends to be better off listening to the decision, whereas before do not. I suppose my fundamental scepticism comes from it, but I cannot believe detect smoking, for instance. I cannot believe there is anybody on the planet who does not know that smoking is bad for you. And yet, it doesn't stop whole large chunks of the population from smoking. What about regulation? Well, we don't use this all that much in the health field. We do compel, there's some compulsory consumption where we compel people to do things, compulsory regulation. The only ones I can think of are fluoridization of water, seatbelts and motorcycle helmets. There may well be others that other people can think of where we actually use compulsion. We use it a lot in other areas of social policy, education, because we compel children to go to school. So not an enormous amount, I think, in health. We do have the other end of it. We have where there's compulsory consumption or compulsory prohibition, where we prohibit illegal drugs, and of course, public speaking public places is a very popular area at the moment.
Vaccination?
What, compulsory vaccination? What?
Very effective.
Right, yes, well, compulsory vaccination. Yes, we can do it. We do, though, automatically run into a problem with any kind of prohibition mechanism or compulsion mechanism. This is a place card I got sent. I happened to work in in government for a while and received and was during the banning of public smoking debate, and I was actually trying to persuade them, having an argument with the Secretary of State for Health, who was mentioned earlier, who objected to the idea of banning smoking in the public place. Got an argument with my second there. It didn't seem like a good career move, actually. But I got sent a number of. A postcard I got from a pro smoking, or rather pro freedom, described as our organisation. But it's a real issue, I do think, that we do hit nanny state objections, where people do say, you give people, why not just give them, give people? The argument I got to in the Secretary of State. He said, why can't we have in every restaurant, in every public house in the UK, why can't we have a room in which no staff goes and only smokers go? So smokers, they want to go, they can take their food, they can take their drink in, and they just have a room. What is wrong with that, in some sense? And actually, that's a difficult argument to argue against, particularly if you're trying to do it on passive smoking grounds or whatever. It's not an unreasonable point. At the end of the day, you have to come down to some kind of paternalist argument. You say, well, at the end of the day, we're going to ban smoking because it would be good for them themselves. Good for them themselves. And that's not always an easy message to sell politically. So, what about the other policies involved? Taxes. We can tax, and indeed we do tax, a lot of these unhealthy behaviours. We tax smoking, we tax drinking. It's interesting that the conventional wisdom on that is often that this is actually a regressive policy, that by taxing smoking and restaurants, it will hit the poor more than the rich. In fact, the evidence tends to suggest, when we look at the price elasticities involved, that the rich have lower prices, rich smokers have lower price elasticities than the poor, which means that, outside the jargon, that means essentially that as you raise taxes, rich smokers carry on smoking, whereas the poor stop. And that means that actually, although the average tax rate may be regressing in the sense it hits the poor more than the rich, the marginal tax rate may be progressive in the sense that it impacts more on the rich than the poor, at least in terms of their incomes and so on, and proportion of income. So actually, raising taxes on cigarette bonds might well reduce health inequalities if we can do it effectively. Of course, we are hamstrung there, well, certainly in the UK, we're hamstrung there by the problem of smuggling. There are some experts that say something like 50% of hand-rolled tobacco is smuggled in the UK, and of course, there's general sort of European Union level question that needs to be resolved. Subsidies, we can subsidise things, and we do subsidise. There have been proposals to subsidise things like gym membership, so to encourage people to take more exercise and so on. I suspect the impact on health inequalities of that will depend very much on the kind of subsidy involved. Subsidising gym membership is just simply, I think, likely to increase health inequalities, because in terms of the better off go to the gym, and actually just means that they'll go more often, or more of the better off will go. There might well be subsidies to certain kinds of healthy foods that might end up subsidising the better, sometimes the less well off, although even then we will probably end up with the result of subsidising the better off even more. Finally then, libertarian determinism. What is libertarian determinism? Well, it basically comes, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, from two authors, Cass Sunstein, who's now a White House advisor, and Richard Thaler, an economist, who produced this article called Libertarian Determinism is Not an Oxymoron. And they just produced a book recently called Nudge, and their argument is that, and it comes again from this behavioral economics view of the world, that says the way people make decisions is crucially dependent upon the way, the frame in which they make those decisions. You change, you make dramatic changes in behavior simply by changing that frame. The classic case is pensions. If you have a pension scheme in which 80% of the people are automatically enrolled in the pension scheme, in which 100% of people are automatically enrolled in the pension scheme, and then they then have an option to opt out. The result is usually about 80% stay in and about 20% opt out. If you have a pension scheme where people have to make a decision where they're automatically out of the pension scheme and they have to make a decision to opt in, again it's 80-20, but in that case 20% opt in. You get enormous differences in behaviour just simply by having a different default position. Organ donation, of course, is the other classic case too. This is more controversial, but there are arguments where we have a system of organ donation where people have to carry a card, so they will have their organs donated. You get far fewer organs available for donation than if you have a situation where organs, people have to carry a card saying their organs will not be donated in the event of an accident. The default is that they will be donated. The evidence there is slightly more controversial. I think it's quite convincing, but again, you get terrific changes in behaviour by simply changing the default. I thought I'd discuss some ideas for trying to apply this in the public health arena. Thaler and Sunstein don't have a great deal on this, and came up with it, caused me a lot of trouble, was this. And the idea essentially was that, that if you wish to smoke, you have to get a permit every year. I think the word permit is slightly misplaced, but you have to supply ID, fill out a form to do so. So every year you have to opt in to being a smoker if you want to be a smoker. The default will be that you're out. So you have to make a conscious decision every year to opt in. And it might be a little difficult, but it wouldn't be very difficult for the permit. Just have to go down to the post office or whatever the government agency it was. But it'd be a little bit of a hassle. It would get in the way of a sort of opportunistic breaking of your New Year's resolution not to smoke. And I think it would be quite effective at stopping. I'm not sure how effective it would be at stopping people who already smoke this, but it might stop people starting. And there's some evidence, there's an interesting article in the Journal of Prison Economy, that measures such as this might be more effective than price rises. I say that Sunstein and Thaler don't really address this kind of issue. They do have one or two other ideas. One of their ideas, which is not wholly dissimilar, is that you can only buy cigarettes in packets of 200. You only buy cigarettes in packets of 200. So again, putting a kind of barrier to the opportunity. And I think it would be progressive. I think it would improve health inequalities if we did it. Of course, there are a number of issues about it. Enforcement, and how would we actually enforce this code? I mean, I think people would just simply have to present an ID when they went along to purchase tobacco. They have to present a permit. I have to say, the idea didn't go. There are other limitations on this idea, a fat tax. I don't know if you might not include that as a limitation, it's just simply a tax. That's a tax that's not a tax on fat people. The tax on fat content of food. Somebody was telling me the other day there is a tax on fat people in Japan. I don't know whether anyone knows this, so I don't confirm this. I'd be interested to know quite how it would work. I think it did exist, it would reduce health inequalities. This was another libertarian determinist idea, which was that every employer should have to every employer would have to offer their employees an hour's exercise every week, or maybe more frequently than that, maybe half an hour every day, or whatever. And the employees would be automatically enrolled in this, but they could opt out of it by writing to the chief executive and saying that they wish to work during the hour instead. I think the result of that would be, I have to say, it's going to increase health inequality rather than reduce it, because it would benefit those sitting in corporate jobs. Salt tax for processed foods. I mean, just instead of adding salt to processed food, which of course they have enormously throughout, so they have a separate salt pack alongside them. If people wish to add it to, they could. Slight problems there, because the salt in processed food is partly used as a preservative. But nonetheless, several alcohol outlets occurs in the United States, actually separate alcohol outlets that are not outlets that are not very attractive. In the UK at the moment, alcohol is sold throughout supermarkets and it's often used, discounts on alcohol are often used as a device for encouraging people to go into the supermarket. I suspect, though, that it probably will increase it. I think it will tend to increase health inequalities, although we could perhaps discuss that. When I suggested the permit to smoke, though, I had problems. It does some. It's one of the very few occasions when I've had an absolutely massive acceptance attack from the tabloids in the UK. Actually, they weren't too bad. The Independent wasn't too bad. But everybody else had a go at me. And really, I'm indebted to my colleague Zach Cooper for finding these. And when he looked on me, my email inbox exploded. Mostly with pictures of Hitler. I have more pictures than anyone would need to. And these were some, you probably won't be able to read these, these are some of the more polite ones. My colleague Zach was generous enough to find some of the nicer ones in here. I have to say, about 99% of this is not wholly a representative list of the results I know. But it does illustrate a key point, but indeed all these measures in some sense, but the dangers of the management, the political problems posed by people's perceptions of a nanny state in this area, or an unjustified intervention in this area, are very real. And it's not something that any policymaker can really ignore. So I just think the key messages coming out of this, incentives do work. I think there's some evidence to suggest they can work. Taxes, certainly. Subsidies, a little more controversial. It depends on the kind of subsidy. some work, some don't. But, I think there's good reason to suppose that nudges libertarian term displeasures could work. However, the effects on health inequality will depend rather crucially on the kind of incentives employed. Changes in apparent and regressive sin taxes, that's taxes on sinning and smoking, etc., will have progressive effects, reduce inequalities. Subsidies, some form of subsidies may make them worse. And finally, that the fear of the nanny state is a real political problem, and it's something that I think we have to address in thinking about these kind of issues. And the consideration, what I quite like, and what slightly surprised me about the reaction to it, libertarian paternalist ideas, is that with libertarian paternalist ideas, it is a very reduced form of the nanny state, because actually the options still remain open to you. You've still got the option of not doing, the option of opting out in case of the exercise hour, the option of opting in the case of the smoking permit. So the options still remain the same. So in some sense they are genuinely libertarian. You are just simply changing the default to try and get the handle. So on that note, I'll stop.
Thank you, Jimmy. So it's time for debate and questions, and then we'll continue with Olga again.
Well,
probably you can ask questions to both
speakers
at the same time. So,
yeah. Thank you. Gerald Walsh from UCL. Julian, your points at the end remind me of a book by Dangerfield, I think, called The Strange Death of The Strange Death of
Liberalism, yes.
Which was attributed to the Liberal Party passing the Adulteration of Food and Drink Act in the 1860s, I think. Which outlawed putting salt in beer and putting chalk in bread, which is still illegal, I think. So there's actually quite a lot more of compulsory consumption or prohibiting its non-consumption in food safety,
yeah.
There's a whole lot of that. But supposedly, you know, this was such an unpopular move by everyone that walked down to the party. So,
very interesting point.
But just other examples of libertarian paternalism. I mean, Nuffield Council took up this idea in their report on public health, and they used the example of the default option on the menu. So, in restaurants, instead of having burger and chips, you could opt for salad. The idea was you had burger and salad that could opt for chips, because you have to have one of them as the default, one of them as the choice. And then it would be encouraging that style of menu creation.
Yes,
well,
I
could have
another
example.
Yes.
Okay, Paul. Thanks very much. I mean, Julian, I think it's also important to run alongside what you're saying about incentives for industry as well, particularly the consumption industry, which I think you were hinting at, but it's not only regulation, it's about market intervention as well, in terms of shaping the markets, and that should be, as we know from tobacco, a comprehensive approach and integrate it. And the sort of things I'm thinking, I'm dealing with it on the supply and demand side, both sides, but I mean, front-of-pack labelling would be an example, because that drives product reformulation, and, you know, which is a huge way in changing the nature of food culture and economy as well. And it's important that it's integrated with things such as social marketing, which comes back to what you're saying about behaviour change, not only in terms of altering the supply, encouraging retailers and producers to produce healthier foods, but also in terms of popular support for radical changes in the industry and all support for those measures as well. So I think it's important to look at it quite comprehensively, and there's lots of parallels with it. How things are being taken forward with tobacco, and you can apply that to all the consumption industry that are potentially health damaging, so you can get a more health creating economy.
Yes, I agree. On the whole, I was crossing on to modern measures,
sure,
but yes, of course, that's the prime measures. I agree. Up front, apparently, the traffic light system of labelling is very important. And I could just tell a little story about that. It was when I was working on it, we were trying to introduce traffic light laws in lots of endless problems in the emerging, particularly in the food industry. And I got taken, I'm not entirely sure if I admit this, but I got taken out to lunch by the head of Cadbury's. And we had this long cigar. He said, well, the trouble is that all our products will be labelled red. And I said, well, yes. And couldn't you reduce, in some sense, the fat and sugar content of your chocolate bars? And he said, look, Julian, he said, chocolate is fat and sugar. Not my entire glass, but actually, if you think about it, yes, it probably is. And he also said, and I had a little bit of sympathy for him, he said, you know, it's hard for us. Most of the big chocolate firms, certainly in the UK, like Cadbury and Roundtree and Fry, were set up by Quakers. And they were set up by Quakers precisely to combat the demon alcohol. And he said, you're now in the process of demonising us. And, you know, and he said, it's hard for us to suddenly be seen, trying to be seen as the saviour of the world, being seen as the demon. So, anyway, the general points on this now.
Hello.
Yeah,
David McDay from the MC. Can I just follow up directly on that? And just really, it's more an observation than a question. It's the extent to which you have to think about the unintended consequences or the spillover effects of, let's say, bringing in draconian legislation to ban smoking. To what extent do people then substitute smoking for some other, you know, hazardous activity, particularly those people living in communities where there might be very little, you know, exciting, healthy alternatives to smoking? So do they start binge drinking more? Do they take up drugs and so forth? So to what extent do you need to think about these other external factors and address those at the same time?
And indeed, when I had my argument with John Reed, the Secretary of State, so that was another argument he'd gotten before. Of course, he got into trouble about it because he got into the press, not from me. He said, well, smoking is one of the few pleasures the poor have. And it is, I believe there is a standard, again, if anyone can point me to this, there's also a rather good diagram I've seen at some point that showed the decline of smoking by doctors in the 50s and 60s, when they began to realise that it goes down like that, and it's almost exactly mirrored by an increase in alcohol consumption.
By doctors. Yeah. Julian, in this country and many other countries, people who are under 18 cannot purchase cigarettes. So they don't need the permit, in fact, but they do smoke. So how are you going to address this problem?
Well, smoking permits won't address.
But this is a major problem. People start smoking when they're between 11 and 15, yeah, rather than after 18.
Well, it still means that somebody has to actually buy it. Somebody has to buy it. One of the things about smoking permit too is that actually you would have ID. You know, you'd have on the smoking permit would be age. It's one way of trying to enforce the age limit. So actually, in order to get the tobacco, you would actually have to display your age. Now, of course, there are obviously problems with smoking and problems with unrelated stuff and that way. But in some sense, we've got to deal with that anyway. So I think that's a bigger problem. So I think, I mean, in some ways, it would actually make the business an enforcement by age.
But that's regulation compulsion.
Well, it's compulsion in the sense that it isn't allowing you to smoke.
When you think of the smoking ban and
pubs
that we have now, all countries, Ireland, Italy, countries where we thought that everybody would be cheating on it, and they followed.
You know? Well, I do think
in the UK, and then it's smoke outside, okay, and calling to other people, but at least they're not smoking in the pubs.
And there's no more at hand.
Well, they may not.
We don't know that,
actually. No, it's not such a challenge. But I agree with you. I'm not knocking all these other means by any manner of means. I mean, the value smoking marketplace, I think, is a very interesting one, actually, in terms of the consequences. And I think it relates to most of what makes to deal with smoking. Of course, I think it's something that's slightly different from, say, prohibition of alcohol in the United States in the 1930s. In that most smokers want to give up, at least say it, 70% wish to give. So in some sense you're nudging people with these measures in a direction they already want to go. And I think that does help in terms of the right banks maybe in other places. But as I say, you do run, even there you do run into libertarian objections, as you did when I was talking to the Secretary of State, who just wanted a separate rule for smokers in restaurants and pubs. Talking about unintended consequences, I do think one of the I know that in Britain that for a very long time they've been trying to develop, particularly in cities like London, a cafe culture, a culture where people sit outside on the pavements. They do it in many continental European countries. And of course, the effect of this value smoking in private places has been a remarkably successful drive to alternative people sitting outside on pavements. and causing us harm to help hasn't there.
Okay. Oliver, do you want to respond to this very emotionally point that Fried?
Yeah, I may say, I mean, a lot of these issues have been dealing with politics, really. And you were raising with, well, what is politics and what is science? And very often, I think, in social science, we're being accused of being political as soon as there is something that isn't really fitting in with the politician's agenda. But I think it's, as you point out, this is really crucial to see that sort of the choice of what kind of society we want, that's a political choice that we should vote on. But sort of the consequences of different choices, that's a scientific issue. I was trying to show some evidence on is that different societies choose different options in terms of welfare policies, and that have different consequences in terms of child poverty, infant mortality, and other stuff. And very often I think that the electorate are not really aware of the consequences. There are much other ideological discussions, and so may be, but I think it's our job to inform the electorate that, well, we may choose this path, but then that might have these consequences in terms of poverty or health or better life. One example is, of course, the healthcare system in the United States. But then, of course, you have all these path dependencies. It's very difficult to break something that is really, really there. And I mean, we have been discussing this with the Monmouth Commission. Well, what can we learn from the Scandinavian countries? And a lot of people say, well, we cannot, because it's a different universe, and to some extent it might be. I mean, we have had state monopolies for alcohol sales for a long time. Sure, it would be a difficult thing to sort of start in the union, I guess. But it had worked well for Scandinavia. The problem is that it's very easy to liberalize, make things more liberal. And the very difficult to go the other way around. It's very easy, I think, to put up Coca-Cola vending machines in schools. Very more difficult to take them out, because then you're sort of you're making liberties smaller. And I think that's a problem to face one way or another. But long answer, but I think it's important to differentiate between the choice of societies and the effects of it.
Okay, I think we have to stop here. I understand that many more questions. It was a fascinating debate. Thank you very much to Martin and Peter as well for participating in this panel. We'll have a break now for about an hour. We'll have a lunch break. I think it's the opposite to this one on the other side of the corridor, 116, if I remember well. So thank you very much.